Hello and welcome to another very special episode of Let Me Explain You a Thing. My name is Andrew, and this is the podcast where I talk extemporaneously on a subject I know a decent amount about. Usually on my drive to work, which is the case right now, so apologies for road noise. It is misting a little bit, so you might hear the wipers occasionally, but that's just part of the experience. And I appreciate you joining me today. We're going to talk a little bit on sort of like a lore subject relating to A Song of Ice and Fire or the series Game of Thrones is based upon. So let's just jump into it. What I was kind of thinking for today is talking about the people of Westeros and maybe a little bit how they relate to people of Essos, because each of these main ethnic groups in Westeros originated in Essos. Fun fact, Essos is never called that in the books. I think they might trot out that term in the show. The books, it's always referred to as across the Narrow Sea or by like some more specific descriptor, such as like, you know, talking about like Slaver's Bay or the Dothraki Sea or the Free Cities or something like that. Usually, like, characters refer to like a more, you know, sub-region within Essos rather than refer to the entire continent. I guess I could also, let's start this off. I'm going to talk a little bit about the geography of the greater world. So, of course, we know we've got Westeros, which is comprised mostly of the Seven Kingdoms, which is a bit of a misnomer because when the Seven Kingdoms were conquered by Aegon, Visenya, and Rhaenys Targaryen. It was one of the Rhae names. There's so many. There's like Rhaenyra. There's Rhaenys. There's a Rhae. There's a Rhaella. I'm pretty sure it's Rhaenys. When the Seven Kingdoms were conquered, the Riverlands and the Iron Islands were technically one kingdom because the then king of the Iron Islands, Harren the Black, Harren of House Hor, Hor spelled H-O-A-R-E, like hoarfrost, but I just, that name is so sick, I love it. Harren of House Hor was the king of a kingdom that was known then as the Islands and Rivers. So basically, he was like king of the Iron Islands. This was before House Greyjoy was, yeah, I believe immediately before House Greyjoy took over. There have been a number of high kings of the Iron Islands. You got House Greyiron, I believe, is like the original one, the OG, like the first Grey King, I believe, was a Greyiron. And then, like, Greyiron died out, and there were some other houses. I want to say, like, House Goodbrother, House Drum. Many of the major houses of the Iron Islands were, at one point, rulers of the Iron Islands. There's another interesting point that a YouTuber and theorist named Preston Jacobs made, in a series of videos, about the election of, I'm getting off track here, but it's a fun tangent. He made a series of videos about the election of Euron as king of the Iron Islands at the Kingsmoot. Kingsmoot, terribly interesting, means of selecting a new ruler. And that, I think, you know, is kind of there to supplement the hereditary monarchy. Like, you have all the High Lords, important warriors, come together as kind of a body of electors, and they, you know, in a very, like, rump sort of fashion, they elect the king by acclamation. It's kind of like how Rob was in a sense, elevated from Lord Paramount of the North to King of the North, King of the North, and King of the Riverlands. We often forget that because Rob was hailed as King of the North, he was also King of the Riverlands, which he laid claim to basically by right of his mother being a Tully. Although, of course, his mother has a brother who would stand to inherit from... What's really interesting is at this time, you know, in that sort of council meeting where all the lords, you know, they're trying to decide what to do, basically, now that Ned has been killed and they're at open war with the Lannisters, and they're trying to decide who to side with, you know, people call out for, like, siding with Renly or with Stannis because he's the rightful king, the rightful heir of Robert. And, you know, somebody brings up the point, like, we are no longer bound by, you know, the Targaryens are now long gone at this point. The dragons are way long gone. We don't have to be part of this political entity anymore of the Seven Kingdoms. But I think that's a really interesting point. Like, legally, sure. I think the buzzer has... What's the metaphor I'm looking for? You know, yeah, nobody's holding you to that really anymore. This is as good a time as any to break off. Although, of course, you know, it does alienate the people who are the other three at that time claimants, who are vying for the Iron Throne of Westeros. Like, they want the whole thing. They don't want the whole thing minus the North. So, you know, definitely limits Rob's options in terms of alliances or marriage alliances at that time. Although I think at that point he had already committed to marrying one of Walder Frey's daughters. But, like, possibly making other marriage pacts between his, like, key nobles in the North and Riverlands and elsewhere in the kingdoms to bring in support. Like, if he had said, you know, nope, I'm going to go by right of conquest and take the Iron Throne for myself, like... Nah, that would probably be more alienating, but breaking off the North rather than just saying, like, hey, we want to, you know, reaching out to Stannis and saying, hey, let's, like, fuck up the Lannisters, I think that would go over, like, you know, with flying colors. Like, he'd be like, yep, let's do it. Maybe not, because Stannis is Stannis. He's a very hard and inflexible man. But probably Renly would be like, yeah, let's fucking go. Anyway, okay, so, yeah, legally, it's an interesting idea, though, and it's funny because, like, Catelyn's, I guess I call her Catelyn, it feels weird, it looks like Caitlyn, but I just can't see her as a Caitlyn, I'm sorry. Sorry to all Caitlyns in the audience. Yeah, Catelyn's father, Hoster Tully, who is at that time still Lord Paramount of the Riverlands, still Lord Tully, he is still alive. He's on his deathbed. He's very sick, but he is still alive. And I don't think Edmure Tully, his son and heir, is even at this meeting. I'm not sure, but, like, a bunch of river lords themselves are like, hey, yeah, King of the North and rivers, which is kind of awkward. It's kind of interesting that they're just like, yeah, let's do this, and it, you know, relies on, like, Edmure being cool with it, essentially, because he I mean, I guess he would be Lord Paramount of the Riverlands either way, and probably, you know, under the King of the North and Rivers, being one of two Lords Paramount, rather than, like, you know, eight, probably better for him, but anyway, it's just kind of interesting that they would take that sitting down and not, like, try to push for some higher, but who knows, maybe not, maybe Edmure clearly is not really thinking everything through. He makes some kind of boneheaded moves. Some that are actually very, like, kind-hearted. Like, he takes in some peasant, you know, refugees from elsewhere in the Riverlands because, you know, they're his subjects and he feels some, like, you know, like, noble duty, some noblesse oblige towards them. Which is great. That's awesome of him. It is kind of a hard time. Like, other characters are like, that's not really helping Edmure. Like, more mouths. and I don't know. You can go back and forth on that. I think, like, it's worth doing in any case. But whatever. He also, like, makes some kind of strategic decisions against what Rob told him that kind of that would have allowed Rob to capture the mountain if it had gone to plan. So that's kind of a big one, a big oversight and a disappointment, but whatever. Rob would be one to bring the mountain to justice, for sure. Anyway, so so we're off on this tangent, but yeah, so the Riverlands was not a kingdom for some time at that point. It was, like, controlled by the Iron Islands, so that's one kingdom. You got the islands and rivers, the north, the Vale, the Westerlands, the Reach, the Stormlands. So that's six. And I think what became the Crownlands, which was ruled more directly by whoever sat the Iron Throne, I believe that was also considered its own kingdom. So those are the seven kingdoms. Dorne was not yet a part of, you know, the seven kingdoms under Aegon. So yeah, so, you know, like, Westeros, the size of the Seven Kingdoms has kind of grown and shrank, I guess, in recent times. And then, of course, you got the Wall. The Wall is an ancient structure dating back thousands of years, probably. Was possibly built by Brandon the Builder using skin-changed giants, or magic or something. You know, along with some of the other most incredible castles in Westeros, like the Storm's End, which has withstood, like, battering storms for centuries or millennia, and the Eyrie, which is, like, this castle on top of a mountain, impossibly high, that can only be reached by a narrow trail, or literally by, like, a basket with a winch. Yeah, so a lot of the Lord's Paramount's castles in Westeros are, like, incredible works of architecture, just amazing engineering feats. Casterly Rock is a castle on top of, like a lonely mountain, basically, that is, like, also within it and throughout it. Anyway, so yeah, the Wall. Beyond the Wall, you got the Lands of Always Winter, which are mapped to some degree, but beyond that, we just don't know. We can assume that the Lands of Always Winter kind of extend up to the North Pole of the planet, but we don't know how expansive they get. We don't know if there's something on the other side. There's kind of an interesting point that, in history, there are the Five Forts, along the eastern verge of this territory in, like, far eastern Essos, along the periphery of the Empire of the Dawn, which is kind of like, you know, Imperial China sort of analog. The Five Forts kind of serve a similar purpose to... They're gigantic, and they kind of serve a similar purpose to the Wall. And there are legends of creatures, demons of some kind, invading the Great Empire of the Dawn from the Grey Waste beyond. The Five Forts, and that the forts were there to help defend against them. So you kind of wonder if maybe, like, the Grey Waste links up with the Lands of Always Winter at some point near the North Pole, and that the others are essentially invading the entire world from whatever land masses, whatever land bridges connect to the North Pole. It's kind of an interesting notion. Neat food for thought. But yeah, so... Okay, Westeros. And then, of course, you've got, like, some small islands called the Summer Islands, like, to the east and south of Westeros. Westeros, through the broken arm of Dorne, had, like, at one time a land bridge connecting to Essos near the... Now what are called the Disputed Lands, kind of a wasteland between Myr, Tyrosh, and Lys. Three former Valyrian city-states that are now, you know, now among the Free Cities. The Free Cities are all, you know, basically all former Valyrian sites. That are now independent city-states, and they make war against each other kind of all the time. There's, Myr, Lys, Tyrosh, Pentos, what's the one Tyrion gets kidnapped in? I'm blanking. That one is, like, the furthest south and probably, and closest to Valyria, probably... has the closest ties to Valyria. They all kind of do. Tyrosh is like an island stronghold. Lys is like supposedly where all the best, like, sex workers, you know, in the world are trained and so forth. Pentos, of course, is where Magister Illyrio lives, who... is kind of working with Dany and Viserys at the start of the series to kind of, you know, like link them up with Khal Drogo and all that, gives them the dragon eggs that he probably couldn't have foreseen would hatch. Definitely a sneaky guy, has something planned. There's also, Lorath and Norvos. Norvos is, like, further inland. It's, these are mostly all coastal, like, across the Narrow Sea from Westeros, but Norvos is, like, further inland. It's where, Doran Martell's wife, originates from. She is not really in the story. They are separated, basically. She kind of, like, leaves to go back to Norvos, but her children include Arianne Martell and... Quentin and Tristane, and due to Dornish law, Arianne, the oldest, even though she's a woman, is Doran's heir, but she's a little hot-headed, gets her into trouble. Quentin is the one who's sent to marry Dany to make good on a decades-old, like, marriage vow between, that was originally supposed to be between Arianne and Viserys, and now Doran sends Quentin to Slaver's Bay to meet up with Dany. It's like, you know, he's not the most inspiring figure. He kind of looks a little frog-like, everyone says. And he arrives, like, days after Danny marries his daughter Zolarak to kind of shore up her control of Marine. So he's just kind of, like, he has bad timing. It's unfortunate. It's kind of, people have kind of wondered, like, for Dorian, who's supposed to be a master plotter, Dorian's also the brother of Oberyn Martell. Well, Oberyn is very hot-headed. Strike first, ask questions later. Dorian is very thoughtful. He's like this gouty old man who, you know, like, sits and thinks. And there's actually a scene where he is, like, watching these, like, overripe, blood oranges fall and splatter in the garden around him. And it kind of suggests that his plans are not just ripening and bearing fruit, but, like, they're overripe. Like, he might have sat a little too long on them. So, I don't know. I kind of think that from a story perspective, like, yes, he... From a story perspective, he is a master plotter. Yeah, I think there's more to his plans than what has been explicitly revealed, but I also think he's maybe a little too clever for his own good, and that's, you know, caused him some problems. He's waited a little bit too long to start acting, so maybe there's some balance that we can glean, something we can learn from the example of Oberyn, who went a little too hard and got killed, and Dorian, who waited too long and, you know, missed his window of opportunity. But anyway, Norvos is also... Dorian has an axeman from the Order of the Bearded Priests of Norvos. They are this group that, they take very strict, dogmatic oaths of service and obedience. And they... He basically... God, his name isn't coming to me. He's always referred to in perspective chapters as, like, the Watcher or something like that. Like, he usually doesn't have a name. Isn't, you know, he has a name, but he's usually not referred to his name. He is kind of treated as, like, being married to his axe, and he kind of unquestioningly follows Dorian's instructions. It's possible that he is maybe beginning to question and to think outside the box a little bit, but we'll see. If we ever get Winds of Winter, we'll find out, I'm sure. But yeah, he's just kind of Dorian's, like, main bodyguard and axeman. And he comes from Norvos. Let's see. So then, Ariohota, that's his name. Ariohota comes from Norvos. Let's see. So then there's also Lorath, which is a very odd settlement. It has some kind of ancient maze at its center. This was also a Valyrian outpost long ago. And then apart from like the other free cities, there's Braavos, which was not directly founded by the Valyrian Empire or Freehold, but by... escaped slaves, refugees of Valyria, who somehow kept Braavos's existence in the foggy lowlands, this, like, little lagoon that they built it in. It's kind of like a medieval Venice analog now, but they somehow kept Braavos' existence a secret for like 300 years after its founding. And it was built as a strongly anti-slavery place. Like, there are other... They're called the Free Cities. Some of the other Free Cities do tacitly allow or practice slavery. Valyria was big on slavery. Braavos has always been very... have taken a very principled stand against. Which kind of makes you wonder, like, if Dany supposedly was raised in Braavos, the Valyrians, which Dany is a descendant of, were very pro-slavery, it just seems weird that anybody who draws water in Braavos would be inclined to shelter, you know, Targaryens. It just kind of beggars belief. But anyway, let's move on to geography. So Essos, yeah, the western portions, you've got the Free Cities. Moving further inland, you've got the Dothraki Sea, which is a vast expanse of mostly unsettled territory roamed by the Dothraki. The Southern Bay, you've got Slaver's Bay, the three slave cities of the old Giscari Empire, the remnants of the old Giscari Empire. There's, going further east, the lands of the Great Empire of the Dawn, and Lang, both kind of like far Eastern Asia analogs, as I mentioned. Further than that, you've got Ashai, which is this like very creepy magical place where people go to learn shadow bending arts, like Melisandre and Miri Mazdur, who did the ritual to bring Khal Drogo back to life, the Lazarine priestess studied in Ashai Beyond the Shadow. Ashai has no, like, children in it, and supposedly drinking the water in Ashai will poison you. So, yeah, weird place. There are some other lands and peoples that, you know, have kind of waxed and waned throughout the centuries and millennia, but we don't need to touch on that quite just now. There's also a continent to the south called Sothorios. Sothorios is like a almost uninhabitable jungle continent. It's kind of giving vibes of like how Westerners understood Africa, you know, in a previous time, as this kind of like dark continent, where, you know, everything was like dangerous and poisonous and like civilization non-existent and stuff like that. Some very warped kind of views, but also like feeding into that some sort of Cthulian kind of overtones. We don't really know much about Sothorios, other than the fact that, you know, most people who go there get like eaten by some kind of poisonous animal, or poisoned, or fall ill to mysterious diseases. And parts of the northern shores of Sothorios were used as like penal colonies by the Valyrians long ago. There's also a continent to the southeast called Ulthos, of which almost nothing is really known. We just know that it's a landmass. And beyond that, we don't know. Like, people have speculated, is there, like, a so-called Americos, like, another continent to the west of Westeros? I kind of think, and I like to think of geography and fantasy stories as kind of reflecting something of the audience. And, for instance, like, Middle Earth, the land of Lord of the Rings, has a vast Western Ocean and some kind of promised land beyond it, where the Valinor dwell, I believe, and stuff like that. And that's kind of interesting to me because it kind of feels like Middle Earth is Europe. Like, you go far enough east, you got the Easterlings, which kind of feel like a stand-in for people of the Middle East. You know, most of Middle Earth represents peoples of Europe. And, you know, like, Tolkien as a philologist was definitely, you know, aware of what he was doing with that. A philologist and, you know, history buff. So, yeah, let's see. But I think that kind of reflects Tolkien living in Britain, in Europe, and having this kind of, like, his world being kind of centered in this landmass that has, like, vaster, you know, lands peopled by, you know, sort of unknowable, you know, other beings, like a kind of Orientalist skew to the people of the Far East. But then, like, there's this Western Ocean, and beyond that, like, some kind of magical land. Like, I don't know, maybe that's me projecting my views as an American onto it a little bit, but I think the idea is that kind of he was centering his world in what he knew. And I think George R. R. Martin, being an American himself, like, making Westeros, which, of course, you've got cities that are a little bit more, that are also Western inspired. Like, we talked about Braavos being across the Narrow Sea, but also based on medieval Venice. I think Venice has some more cosmopolitan kind of vibes, and Westeros is definitely very strongly medieval Europe. You know, you've got, like the Reach, which is the heart of chivalry in Westeros, that feels very much like medieval France. You've got the North, which feels kind of like, you know, medieval Scotland or something. You've got Dorne, which feels like medieval Spain. It's all very, like, Europe, and especially Western Central European inspired. So I don't really believe there is an Americos. I think if you keep going west, you'll hit Eastern Essos. But that remains to be seen. I do think some character at the end of the story is probably going to go off exploring and be, like, the first, you know, Magellan or, you know, Columbus or what have you. Except hopefully, you know, not like Columbus. And discover, you know, find, like, sea passages, or, you know, discover other lands that maybe aren't peopled, or maybe just find new connections with other lands that are peopled. Who knows? From the Westerosi perspective. We don't know yet. I do think Arya is a good candidate for that, but, you know, who knows? Obviously, at the end of the show, she ended up doing that. And I think that feels kind of consistent with her character. I don't really see her being able to go home and live a normal life after the events of the series. Especially after whatever the final climax ends up being. Whether it be between the others or the Iron Throne, who knows. Okay. So, talking about mass migrations to Westeros, because in the Dawn Age, in the early, early days, as far as we know, Westeros was only populated by the Children of the Forest and the Giants, as, like, the sapient, you know, species of Westeros. At some point, you know, many, many thousands of years ago, the First Men arrived over the land bridge of Dorne. which at that time was a cohesive land bridge. They walked from Essos migrating, similar to the indigenous peoples of the Americas crossing the Bering Strait. I think that theory is kind of, you know, reflected in what George has done with the First Men and Westeros. The First Men made war on the Children of the Forest for many, many years, using their bronze weaponry. Children only had obsidian. The Children, that's also the name given to them by the First Men due to their smaller stature. Although the Children have said that they refer to themselves as those who sing the song of the earth. Something like that. I might be getting it a little wrong. But they call themselves the Singers. Which, you know, A Song of Ice and Fire? Interesting. Maybe there's some connection there. But yeah, so the Children are almost eliminated by the First Men, but then they sign the pact. The First Men take on the worship of the Children's deities, the old gods. And the timeline is a little skewed. I think, referring to a theory by the YouTuber, I didn't really talk about the King's Moon. That would be a good topic for another video, speaking of YouTubers. Maybe I'll talk about Preston Jacobs' theory sometime. That would be fun. But the YouTuber David Lightbringer has a theory that the timeline, it's called Timeline Heresy if you want to look it up. But he has a theory that, kind of like a body of theories, that the timeline as represented it by the Maesters is not accurate, and that it would make more sense if instead of the pact being signed to end the war, and then the Long Night happens, if the Long Night is the inciting incident for the pact being signed, like, rather than just the Children and First Men getting tired of the war, that, you know, they maybe need to put aside their differences and link up against a common enemy, the Others. That's why they signed the pact. That's why the First Men take on, you know, abandon their old gods and take on the worship of the old gods. At some point, there were older gods, fun fact. But they take on the worship of the old gods. It just kind of makes things make a little bit more sense, timeline-wise. I encourage you to look into that theory if it interests you, but he has more to say. But, So the theory of... that's Timeline Heresy. That's the pact. The First Men, you know, the Children are eventually relegated to the Deep Woods, which also doesn't really make sense. Like, it doesn't seem very equitable for the First Men to get all of the lands and the Children to just get, like, some Deep Woods when, you know, the First Men also inhabit castles such as Deepwood Moat. No, it's not Moat. Deepwood Mott. It's like a Mott and Bailey castle. Deepwood Mott in the north. And other such woodland areas, such as the Wolf's Wood. It doesn't quite make sense, but whatever. After the First Men, you've got the invasion of the Andals from a region of northwestern Essos called Andalos. The Andals bring the worship of the Seven, which is sort of the Catholic Church analogy of the series. Seven gods in one is very reminiscent of the Trinity, and they have a organized priesthood and sacred text called the Five-Pointed Star, the Seven-Pointed Star, that just reads a lot like, you know, the Catholic clergy in the Bible, also the only religion to not have evinced any direct magic, although there are kind of magical legends being told of, like, the maiden having gifted a hero a Valyrian, not a Valyrian steel sword, but some kind of magic sword that later became conflated with Valyrian steel. So... yeah, magic sword more powerful than Valyrian steel. Legends of magical, you know, acts in the past, but no direct magic being seen in the current day, which is unlike what we see through R'hllor, which is a little bit like Zoroastrianism, I think, but also kind of has very dogmatic Christian kind of vibes, maybe evangelical sort of vibes on a certain level. Protestantism, maybe. Or Calvinism, you could say, I think. There's a lot going into that stew. But anyway, so you got the first men, the Andals. The Andals invade Westeros starting in the Vale by crossing the Narrow Sea. They bring with them iron, which, you know, is superior to the bronze weaponry. Excuse me, bronze weaponry of the first men. It's not just that in a 1v1 scenario, like, an iron weapon is superior to a bronze weapon. Although, yeah, iron is stronger. Like, it can take more of a beating before it breaks. It keeps an edge better. Yes, iron weapons are superior to bronze, and iron armor is superior to bronze armor. But the real truth of it in history, in our world, was that the Iron Age kind of supplanted the Bronze Age, and any Iron Age civilizations were able to overtake Bronze Age civilizations because bronze is an alloy of tin and copper, and tin is just relatively scarce. Iron is much more common than tin in the world, like, both in where it is found in the world, and also, like, just in its sheer abundance. So if you have the technology to work iron, you are going to find iron more places and have a better time, like, crafting with iron than trying to source tin to alloy into bronze. So that's kind of the fact of the matter there. It's just a numbers game, really. It's not just, like, you know, two armies equally equipped in iron and bronze meet in battle, and, like, the bronze team eats shit because, you know, it's like, squishy next to, you know, sharp, powerful iron or something. That's part of the story, but not the whole story. Anyway, so the Iron and Bronze Age migrations kind of play out with the First Men and the Andals. The Andals bring knighthood, and which is very closely aligned with the Faith of the Seven, to Westeros. The Andals are able to successfully invade basically the whole continent. There are areas that are more or less First Men. Most areas of Westeros, there is, you know, kind of intermixing of the two populations, which is really how you know, for as much as some characters in the story care about, like, bloodlines and ancestry and, you know, their ethnic identity, which is, like, on the one hand, like, you know, okay, and on the other, not, like, you know, like, genetics is one thing, it's not the only thing. And whenever a character claims to have, like, really, you know, like, pure First Men, you know, descent, it means that they're very, you know, probably isolated or possibly inbred to just keep that going. Like, if, you know, like, even as inbred as the Valyrians are, like, chronically, very deeply inbred as the Valyrians, not just the Valyrians, but the Targaryens. Like, Dany, due to, like, marrying, like, various Targaryens marrying in her lineage, marrying, like, marrying Danes or marrying Blackwoods or whatever, other houses outside the Valyrians, she is, like, not very Valyrian, which is just kind of ironic. Like, you know, for all the talk of, like, keeping, you know, bloodlines pure and stuff like that, which is a dangerous conversation, but it's also just, like, kind of foolish. Like, you just can't do it. there are, like, three Valyrian families in Westeros, and, you know, any amount of marriage outside those families is going to result in, you know... Dany is, like... I saw a Reddit thread. Somebody did the math. Dany is, like, 12% Valyrian or something. It's, like, Dany is less Valyrian than I am Swedish with one Swedish grandparent. You know, like, I'm not very, like... you know, I do not have a very strong, like, Swedish-American identity, and that's just due to having one grandparent be Swedish. You know, it's just kind of... Anyway. It's funny. But yeah, so, Dany... Where was I talking? Yeah, so the First Men, then the Andals, and then the... We have a period of stasis for several thousand years where, like, Andal culture kind of overtakes most of Westeros, except in the north. The north was the one place that, due to Moat Cailin and the Neck, the Andals were never successful in invading. Of course, later inroads were made through marriages and different alliances, but for the most part, the north is pretty predominantly First Men still. But everywhere else, you know, like, Dorne has the, stony, sandy, and salty Dornish are kind of the three ethnic groups, or three of the main ethnic groups of Dorne. The stony Dornish have the most First Men ancestry. The sandy are more Andal, I believe, and then the salty are the most Roynish. The Roynish, I'm kind of close to work, so I'll just cap it off talking about the Roynish. They settled in Dorne after many tribulations. They were basically evicted from their homeland, the Mother Royne, which is a major river in Essos, after being conquered by the Valyrians. The princess Nymeria led the so-called 10,000 ships on this odyssey around the known world, settling in different places, sometimes just for a while, sometimes with disastrous consequences. Like, she went to Sothorios, and a lot of her people got sick and died. The ships occasionally were attacked by pirates. A lot of really rough stuff happened on that journey, but eventually she settled in Dorne, married a Martell, became Princess of Dorne, instituted you know, the Roynish custom of old absolute primogeniture, which is the first child inherits, as I mentioned with Arianne Martell. That survives to the present day in Dorne, even among houses that are not especially Roynish in their culture or ancestry. So the first child inherits regardless of gender. That is one of the surviving Roynish customs. But otherwise, the Roynish mostly settled in Dorne. They burned their ships to symbolize that they would no longer be looking for a homeland elsewhere. And Nymeria did her best to integrate her people into Dorne. And yeah, so that kind of explains some of Dorne's traditions that and customs that vary from what we, you know, see of the other kingdoms. For instance, nobles having paramours or openly having, you know, illegitimate or non-inheriting children with paramours, such as Oberyn Martell. He takes it to kind of a further extreme, but it's usually, like, pretty okay. Like, his paramour, Ilaria Sand, is also, you know, I mean, Sand, she is the illegitimate child of House Uller. So, which is Sandy Dornish. Kind of interesting. Anyway, so... Oh, yeah, and they're called that because the Stony Dornish mostly inhabit, like, the mountainous pass between Dorne and the Stormlands, and the Reach, that region, such as House Ironwood, Blackmont, I believe, is another one up there. The Stony, or the Sandy Dornish inhabit, like, the deep deserts of Dorne, like House Uller. And then the Sandy, or the Salty Dornish inhabit the coastline and are mostly more Roynish than the other houses. But yeah, so the Roynish, very neat, you know, population. The final migration, that was like 700 years before the events of this story, that the Roynish migrated. Let's see. So you got the Roynish. There's the Valyrians, which migrated in very small numbers, basically just two houses. The Targaryens, which were a lesser house of Valyria, and eventually, of course, gained the Iron Throne, or created the Iron Throne, established high kingship over the many smaller kingdoms of Westeros. And let's see. And then there's also, like, the Valarians, another Valyrian house that left for Westeros earlier. Probably why they're called the Valarians. Probably some corruption of, like, Valyrian. Like, the Westerosi just were like, oh, yeah, you guys are Valyrians. That's your name. it's kind of like the name of Canada. Look it up. Yeah, so, anyway, it's possible that there could be further migrations into Westeros in the story. Like, we could see Dany leading a bunch of Dothraki to settle in Westeros. That would be really interesting. So it's possible that the, like, face of Westeros could still be reshaped politically and demographically. Would be really interesting. I don't know. I think this is kind of an interesting story in how it kind of mirrors the ways that, you know, populations move and migrate and, you know, nations change over time in the story of the Song of Ice and Fire, Game of Thrones. And I think that's really interesting. I think there are a lot of interesting, like, you know, stories of, you know, the immigrant experience that are told through the story. Not so much in the present day, although a little bit with Dany kind of in reverse, but definitely in the histories, like the story of Nymeria and the 10,000 ships. Absolutely. And in other cases, the stories of colonialism and, you know, colonization by, you know, It's kind of interesting, you know, in some ways that can be kind of a perspective thing, but in others it's pretty clear cut. Like, what we see the First Men doing at first is, you know, yeah, kind of horrendous. The Andals also, like, you know, they're there to subjugate. So anyway, lots of interesting stories there, and that's just kind of in the background, and that's what is meant when, you know, people describe the monarch in Westeros whoever sits the Iron Throne as, you know, Lord of the Seven Kingdoms, and, you know, King of the First Men, the Andals, and the Rhoynar. So, yeah. Anyway, I'm at my destination, so I'm going to cap it there. But thank you guys so much for listening, as always. Shout out to Scott Suter for the intro and outro themes. Find him on Instagram at Copenhagen Cool Ranch and TikTok as well at that handle. My boy's in zines now with his comics, so congrats. Anyway, if you're falling asleep, I hope you've enjoyed this white noise. And otherwise, have a great day, guys. See you all next time. Bye-bye.